This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, jump on the train or get off the tracks. Pacing, prologues, and bridging distance in speculative fiction.
I love the imagery that this title evokes.
See, it's great, but I can't take credit for it. I kind of stole it from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. But it worked really well for this particular episode, so it's borrowed.
Yeah, fair enough. Nice little reference there. So why have we decided to talk about this subject today?
Well, for one thing, it's been... We have done a spate of sort of writing episodes recently, but we've also done some more sort of, you know, talking about what we've enjoyed type episodes as well.
Yeah.
And tropes and things we've enjoyed. And this is quite a technical aspect of writing that we've never, ever really covered.
Yeah. And actually, one thing that I've noticed is that pacing is something that I end up frequently talking to my students about. It's actually a really key part of writing. And I think the particular reason that it can get confusing, as we'll go into it, is that pacing means more than one thing, really. So I guess we should probably talk about what pace is.
Yeah, pacing, obviously, in book terms. Normally when someone says pacing, you're assuming, or when a reviewer says pacing, what they're talking about is how fast or slow they felt the book was. Mm-hmm. And as Madeleine said, there's a bit more to it than that.
It's quite complicated, because in terms of, like, musicality and stuff like that, pacing isn't necessarily actually how quick you get to the destination. It's actually to do with sort of how quickly you hit each of the beats. So the best way of looking at it is as if you are walking with a toddler, right? And you start from A and you get to B at the same time. So essentially what's happening is that you are walking at the same pace. But the toddler is taking like a million more steps than you. His little feet are going diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle-diddle. And in this particular way, what's happening is that the toddler has got a much faster rhythm. The rhythm of their steps is much faster, but the pace remains the same. They're getting to A to B within the same amount of time. And it kind of works like that in writing as well.
So just backtracking a little bit, pacing in writing is how fast or slow you arrive at the story beats. So there are bits in a story that you need to have there. This, you know, we'll talk a little bit about pacing with structure a bit later, but there are things that need to happen. So obviously you need your inciting incident, you need your moment of greatest despair, you need your midpoint and your look in the mirror moment. And it's how fast or slow you get to those and to minor beats in between. And the thing to remember is that these beats will vary depending on genre, and how fast or slow you get to them will depend again on genre.
There is also a difference between the pace of writing and the pace of the book. And maybe, I'm not sure whether Jules will agree with me here, but so in the when I talk about sort of the pace of the writing, you can actually end up having a pace of writing which is very slow, but the pace of story which is too fast. And when I say that, I mean that sometimes you can have sentences which really slow the pace down. So very long, long sentences. You would want that, you know, obviously, if you want to kind of slow things down. But long sentences. But if the long sentences are full of telling rather than showing, and these long sentences are actually basically getting you from A to B to C to D very, very fast, what happens is that the pace of the writing is slow, which means that the way that people read it is slow or laborious, but the events in the story are happening too fast. And that tends to be a product of telling someone what's happening rather than showing it and allowing it to happen naturally. But today we're going to be concentrating on the pace of the story rather than the pace of writing.
Yeah, I mean, the pace of writing will come into it a bit later, but let's start from the eagle eye view and work our way inward.
Yes.
So when I was talking about your pacing will depend a little bit. How fast, let's just say it's how fast or slow you tackle story beats within a given narrative. And that will depend, you know, whether you want them to be fast or slow or somewhere in between will depend a bit, as I said, on genre. So here's a couple of examples. If you have an action thriller, you tend to hit more beats. So let's say you had 30 beats in a story. Obviously, you'll have loads more than that. But you might hit 20 of them at full speed because mm-hmm. it's an action thriller. And you need that sense of fast tension, if you like. You need that sense of pace, of things happening, of, you know, only just struggling to get through each different difficulty as the character goes towards the end of the story arc.
Great acceleration.
But you don't want all of them to be that fast. You need some time in between, and we'll explain why a bit later.
Yeah.
Now, if you were taking a psychological thriller, you would probably find that it needs time. It needs far more time. So you might end up splitting the beats. So say having 17 of the beats, you'd hit them quite slowly, and then 13 of them you'd hit quite fast, and you'd vary back and forth. But you'd have more fast beats towards the end of the book as you hit towards the conclusion. At the beginning, it would be slow because you want them to actually build tension.
Hmm.
This isn't obviously the same as how a reader experiences a book. This is literally just talking about the mechanics of creating pace within a story. We will talk about reader experience again a bit later. So three different things with pacing already. It's how fast or slow you mechanically hit story beats. It's how a reader perceives the book once it's written and they experience it. And also there is the sheer act of the physical writing itself, how fast or slow certain paragraphs and things are, and thinking about sentence structure. Mm. So there you go, three things with pacing already to think about.
Yeah. So let's go through them a little bit more detail.
I think we should, let's look at a few more different genres and pacing-wise before we go on to that, because I think it's worth it to get people thinking about pacing within books.
Yeah, definitely.
Because you can read anything in any genre and think, oh, wow, my God, that was amazing. It was so fast. I just flew through the book. And that doesn't necessarily mean anything about pacing. That just means that book absolutely ticked your boxes for you. So you experienced it in a very fast way. So in science fiction and fantasy terms, you can have books that are weighted far more to the slower end of the spectrum and far more to the faster end of the spectrum.
Hmm.
It depends a little bit on subgenre. Certainly the big sprawling fantasy epics that go on for 12, 15 books and they're sort of like 600 pages a pop.
Looking at you, Wheel of Time.
Looking at you, Wheel of Time, with a little side eye. You, Terry Goodkind, books that don't even need to be there at all. I have to get one in. And actually, George R. R. Martin's books as well. Yeah, they're big books. The whole point is you should be experiencing the world, that there's a huge world there. You need that space in order for the world to unfold. Therefore, the story beats, while you will have fast beats where you think, oh shit, Ned Stark's just lost his head. I can't believe that just happened. Most of the story beats are largely quite slow, or they're tackled in a slow way because you're getting this unfolding of the world and you're getting a bit more detail each time.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a way of tricking your reader into consuming lots of information.
Yeah. And certainly I think one thing that really contributes to that is that, and the way that Martin really makes that work, is that obviously he has multiple points of view.
Yeah.
Multiple storylines, which means that actually if you read each book and only read one particular storyline for each of them, you would actually find a more condensed story.
Yeah, but have a series of actually fairly short novellas or 150-page books. It'd be kind of like Warhammer 40k, where you have these books that are usually no more than 200 pages, 300 at the most, and they're really quick to read because there's not a lot of necessary depth because the world's already been established, the universe is established, everyone accepts that's what it's like. Fans of that universe already go in to read those books because they like that universe, they know how it works.
Yeah.
So no one has to spend a lot of time world building. But I mean, generally speaking, most of us need to establish world building before we can go anywhere. So, you know, that's partly what your slow beats are for. Your slow beats are for painting in a bit more of the background, if you like, putting in a bit more world, adding in some dialogue and things as well, but not expositionary dialogue, obviously. One of my bugbears. And for gradually creating suspense and tension. Also, they're reflective as well, if you think about it. You can't just have fight scene after fight scene after fight scene after fight scene, because after a while, you just get a meaningless mess.
Looking at you, Dragon Ball Z. No, I'm sorry.
there's definitely a bit of side-eyeing going on today, I'm afraid, because it is what it is in that respect. But you can also have fantasy that's incredibly fast-paced as well. You can have much shorter books that don't invest lots of time in world building and multiple subplots and multiple storylines and things.
Yeah.
And they still feel rich and immersive. Although if you then really started boiling them down, you'd be thinking, actually, I'm assuming a lot about this. So things like Sabriel or the Apporson series by Garth Nix, they're very fast-paced books.
Yeah. I also think that a lot of urban fantasy falls into that genre. Also because usually it's in a world in which we kind of already know and understand. So
yeah. Urban fantasy also does have the benefit, generally, most of it is very long series. And I say this as someone who is absolutely guilty of starting writing a very long series in urban fantasy at the moment. And it's a case of you build on from previous books. So you're not having to establish lots of world building in the first book. You just need enough for that story. And then you add a bit more to the world in the next book and the next book and the next book. And people love them because they're kind of they're ready meals. They are the ready meals of fantasy fiction in a way. And there's nothing wrong with that. You like them. You consume a lot of them. You think there's 15 books. I've got 2 weeks off. I'm just going to go through the lot.
Yeah, definitely. Nothing wrong with that at all. I think the other thing with urban fantasy is that it's actually tends to be usually has this slight mix in genres, because other genres will have different pacing. So I actually think, well, the mysteries and stuff like that, in the way that pacing works in sort of detective stories, is that they're actually quite. They tend to have quite a regular pace, slower at the beginning and then moving a little bit faster. But certainly in terms of kind of a lot of the, you know, the detective stories, I actually tend to find that they're kind of consistent throughout.
Yeah, and it's an unusual example, really, in the sense of finding ones that are actually fairly consistent pace-wise, or rather the changes of pace are quite subtle.
Yeah.
Because however you experience a book as a reader, basically books are not all one pace all the way through, but you shouldn't necessarily be aware of having the pace changed on you as a reader until you get to the end, unless you happen to be a writer, and then you will notice it because you can't help it.
I
had a metaphor for this, and this was it's a bit silly really, but any of you people who are into theme parks and you know, your more extreme rides, like some of the faster roller coasters and things, when you get on a roller coaster, they'll tell you in like the copy, the adverts for the roller coaster, that it goes for, I don't know, 0-60 miles per hour in 3 seconds.
Mm.
And they'll say, you know, this is the fastest roller coaster, it gets up to this speed. And you think that it's doing that speed all the way around, but it's not. It's actually slowing down and speeding up on different parts of the track. And part of this is a safety issue. And part of this is a case of, if you went one speed all the way through, you'd become accustomed to it and it wouldn't be thrilling anymore.
Yeah.
But you're not aware of it. Even when you get off the ride, you still think, oh my god, that was, you know, an incredibly fast roller coaster. or what have you. Oh, that was brilliant. I want to go again. It was such a thrill. but yeah, obviously they're not giving you one speed all the way around. I'm sorry if I'm bursting someone's bubble with this. That you weren't actually travelling at 100 miles per hour for three goes around the Hulk track or anything. But you really weren't.
I think you're fine.
It's like they'll slow it down. Something's gone wrong if they haven't slowed down in certain areas, put it that way. And it's the same with a book. Someone should come out of a book feeling like they've travelled through the book at one speed almost, but that it got them to the end at exactly the moment it was supposed to. And it's only on looking back that they think, actually, we went fast, we went slow, we went semi-fast, we went semi-slow.
Absolutely. But I really do feel like that when it comes to mystery novels, there is this sense of acceleration, but it's quite evenly paced, particularly things which, such as things like Sherlock Holmes, for instance, the very traditional kind of detective stories, they are quite evenly paced. That's probably because they're relatively tame, to be honest, and they're short stories as well.
Agatha Christie as well.
Yeah, Agatha Christie is, yeah, it's a perfect example. And so I think that urban fantasy kind of taps into that a little bit, but urban fantasy does tend to kind of pull you in straight away, tends to have this sense of acceleration. Again, it's not just a simple matter of, you speed up and you slow down, you speed up, you slow down. But in the general pattern, I tend to find that there is just a very gradual kind of acceleration and then a slowdown at the end, just like a roller coaster. And it tends to be a little bit more paced. Sorry, that's a terrible word to use here, considering talking about pace. But it tends to be a little bit more kind of even, I guess, than some other genres, where it can be a little bit more erratic. But as Jules said, this is not actually about how the reader reads it, but more about the way that you hit those story beats.
Yeah, and certainly taking urban fantasy as an example, you may well find as you're writing a book that it sort of takes off without you, like the clappers kind of thing. This is something that I found myself, as in I've been writing a book, and it's happened a lot of times, not just to me, but also to one of my writing buddies. And we've now got to the thing where we say, oh, I finished a book. And the other one will go, okay, so what happened at the end there? And it's like, well, it did the rushing thing where it just sort of like started hurtling towards the conclusion and I could barely hold on the reins long enough.
Yeah.
And it is like that. And it's particularly like that, I find, with writing urban fantasy. With writing something like historical fiction, I found that it's a case of, no, we're getting there and we're going to get there at a decent time, but we don't need to take off at breakneck speed. But whereas with urban fantasy, it's a case of, no, we're going to write the last quarter of this book this afternoon. I hope you didn't have any other plans because it's happening.
Buckle in, kids, we're in for a wild ride.
And it's a really interesting sensation, shall we say. That happened recently with one of the series I've been writing. I got something like three quarters of the way through, and I'm sure for a week I was saying to Madeline, I've nearly finished this book, I've nearly finished it.
Yeah.
And I had a quarter of a book to write, and then suddenly it's like, oh my god, it's over. It's just gone.
You know I hate you sometimes, right?
I'm sorry.
I hate you with great admiration.
Well, in theory, you could potentially benefit from some of these.
Yeah, which is why I don't completely hate you.
This is writing buddyship in action, people. Okay, let's have a quick look at pacing and structure. You know, obviously, that I will take any excuse to talk about structure because it is one of my big issues.
It is. When in doubt...
It is something that's worth thinking about. And I suppose that's the thing with all aspects of writing. Obviously, for ease, Madeline and I have split up basically how to write a book podcast for you into easy sections like pacing and structure and dialogue and things like that. But you need to consider everything together. We're just giving you bite-sized chunks, ultimately. Pacing and structure, you can't entirely separate them. As we've said, pacing has a lot to do with genre. Structure... you will have basic things that are in the right place, like your inciting incident, your midpoint, your, you know, moment of greatest despair, when everything looks like it's all lost. No matter what genre you're writing, you'll have that. In romance, I think that's called the point of ritual death, which might mean an actual character death, or it might mean the death of somebody's hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
And so you will have all of those things in a book, and they will happen slightly differently depending on the genre. How you approach those particular big beats, again, depends on your genre, but you need to bear it in mind as you're looking at them.
Yeah. And the thing is that you can use a template. You could use any of the kind of structures that you tend to get. And for the most part, a lot of these kind of structures, you can actually fit them to whatever story. So, you know, I use the monomyth a lot, so I use the hero's journey a lot in my writing. But it's not enough to basically say, I use the monomyth and we looked at how, you know, it can be applied to different things. So we take a mystery novel, or I use Disney's Moana, for instance.
Yeah.
And you can make it fit. You can absolutely make it fit. But one thing that people noted was, hold on a second, it's not all happening, you know, the hero's journey is always depicted in a circle. The way each of the points are placed makes it seem like, right, we get to this and then we get to this and it's all evenly spaced. It's not. It's absolutely not. I mean, there's the Road of Trials, which for some books or for some stories, that single point will take up half of the story, at least.
If not more.
If not more, and will have within itself these different kind of, you know, these different points. I mean, the whole point of the Odyssey, for instance, is that the pretty much the entire journey.
This is how I waste 10 years getting home, even though it usually only takes 3 months.
So, yeah, basically, yeah, you've got this. It's not paced in the way that it's depicted. And depending on what genre you are writing, you might have every single one of those points, but they're gonna maybe appear sometimes in different orders, sometimes at different times, sometimes that you won't even have some of them at all. And actually, writing therefore in a genre, it's a really good idea to actually look at the structure of something else that is written within that genre to see how they have paced out the events.
Yeah, absolutely. Other things to think about with structure, obviously you're looking at a scene type level. Yes, action scenes tend to be faster paced. However, if you make them too fast paced, you end up with a frenetic mess, like Michael Bay, for example, with his awful Transformers films and pretty much everything else he touches. It's all just so fast paced, it's nonsense. It's kind of like mashing keys on a keyboard all together at once. You can't really necessarily get a tune out of it because you're playing everything on top of each other. So,
yeah,
you know, there might be lots of colour and lots of movement, but if honestly, you're going to make your reader stop caring. If you pull that too many times, your reader is going to stop caring about the characters and they'll put the book down.
To use a music term, something that was, you know, pointed out to me that I really liked was that in music, the silence is as important as the notes.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's the same in writing. Those slow moments, it's like basically if you want that reverb, if you want to hear the echo, if you want to have that moment of, you know, when you hear something loud, actually, the thing that kind of makes it shocking is if it's sudden and then there's a moment afterwards where everything is completely silent and the sound is just reverberating.
Yeah, there has to be contrast in order for there, you know, without darkness, you can't have light. So it's like that. Sorry, you've made me laugh a bit with the whole silence thing because I'm like, I literally wrote the second book about that. You need to play the silences, the bits in between are also important. But yeah, obviously, as Madeline said, the contrast and how you approach action is really important pace-wise. I would say if you're writing an action scene, for example, a fight scene, keep your descriptions short and punchy. No pun intended. But, you know, you can have a series of short sentences one after the other is almost as if they're physical blows themselves, than a longer sentence explaining what that's actually done to that particular character. And you can sort of switch back and forth between the two. So we're sort of heading into the pacing territory whereby we're looking at how you write. And this is an area where if you've got action, you do want a fair bit of tell. You don't want too much show.
Yeah.
You certainly want to vary. Again, it's the contrast. Because if you're sort of showing the character really feeling and experiencing every single blow, then you're going to slow your action down and it's not going to be very action-y.
Yeah, absolutely. Here we have we come back to our little toddler. Quick steps. Lots of action happening in a short pace of time. A short space of time. Oh God, I'm going to keep making that mistake. In a short space of time. Because you want it. You want that great sense of movement. You want that great sense of acceleration. At the same time, it's basically about how you compact lots of movement into a short space. So you, as Jules says, you want those shorter sentences. I would say vary your sentence length a little. If you have basically a bunch and a bunch and a bunch of sentences which are all exactly the same length, even if they're short, that is not actually going to end up quickening the pace of the writing. It's going to end up setting up a sense of rhythm which actually will kind of disturb it. So you do want to have short, sharp, a slightly longer one, another short one, a slightly longer one, short, and then very short and then sharp. So do vary sentence length, because that will also get this sense of movement that's incorporated into an action scene. It's kind of like having the sense of dodging and moving and shifting, where you're kind of stopping, starting, but without ever actually stopping. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Ultimately, if you're unsure, then think of the rule of three. If you've used a particular thing three times, then use something else. So try not to have sentences that start with I three times in a row, for example. Or, you know, don't go into a fourth time. The fourth time is a case of you've hit a red flag in a reader's head. And I suppose it's the same. Three short sentences, you probably get away with that. Start with there. And then when you go back through and rewrite and edit it, you'll probably think, oh, I want to vary the pace a bit. Because it's a lot to think about when you're writing a first draft, to think about all these things and structure and pacing and dialogue and everything else.
My recommendation is also, when you're writing scenes like that, read them out loud to yourself. That is the best way of actually getting a sense of the pace of the writing, is to read it out loud to yourself, not in your head. Because when you read it out loud, you hear it as it kind of, you hear it out loud. You hear it as it's being said, with natural human inflection, with natural human speaking pace and things like that. That will give you a really, really good sense of whether it's the pace is dragging at a point where you actually want it to be quick, or whether it is actually does actually have that great sense of movement that you're looking for.
Yeah. Slower scenes, obviously, you can go for a slower pace, you can go for a little bit more exposition, and you can go for a bit more deeper, heavier character development. If you bog it down with too much detail, it will become so slow, your reader will become bored and put the book down. So
yeah,
it's balance all the way through with these things.
Ultimately, what you want is you want things to keep moving at all times, never to draw to a halt. And this is where show, don't tell really comes into it. Because as Jules said, in a fight scene, when you actually have lots of short sentences, or I don't just say fight scene, in an action scene where you are actually telling a lot because you need to get sort of lots of things happening at once, that's okay. But if you're meant to be writing a slow-paced scene, where you're setting stuff up, you do want to show rather than tell. Because if you have long sentences which are full of tell, it just grinds everything. It grinds everything to a halt. It's not immersive at all. So it's about finding that balance.
Yeah, definitely. Tell is obviously best for shortening the distance between two points. But the whole point is the journey a lot of the time. The journey in terms of narrative arc. If we're talking an actual journey in fiction, unless we're talking about the journey being the story, as Madeline said earlier, then you're best off leaving the journey out altogether and not having a lot of tell. It's like, you don't actually owe the journey of they got in the car and they drove down to Wolverhampton to anybody, and nobody really wants to read it unless a manticore attacks the car on the way, you know?
Or you have some amusing dialogue. character building dialogue.
Yeah, I think the other perception is that slower paced scenes are not exciting, and it's simply not true. Slower paced scenes can be some of the best bits. I love a good action scene, but I need to really care about the characters, otherwise it's kind of, oh, he's lost his head, so what, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas a slower paced scene can drip feed you information in ways that gets you thinking about the characters even as they're fighting in mortal peril in the next action scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they should be as exciting as your action scenes.
Yeah. I think of the Avengers, actually. It makes me think of the Avengers movie, I think, is actually a really good sort of example of that, in that you can think of lots of great bits in the action scenes, but actually some of the really, really, really wonderful bits that mattered were those slower scenes that happened, and it just would not have been the same story without them.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you compare that to, say, again, a Transformers film, you can come out, I haven't even seen all of them, but it's a case of, you come out thinking, I don't actually know what the story really was there. There were some giant robots who were looking for something, and then everything went pear-shaped, and then it ended. And it was literally just colour and explosions and lots of noise. And it's a way of cheating your reader, to be honest, so that you don't have to describe things in a way that they can experience, rather than telling them something's happened. And we don't like lazy writing.
No.
Okay, let's look at pacing and young adult fiction. And this isn't me particularly picking on young adult fiction. It's just that I've noticed the trend in that particular umbrella genre. I think it's probably been more obvious to me because I've read more young adult fiction that I wouldn't necessarily have picked up because I've been offered advanced review copies. So, you know, instead of being sort of really picky and sort of like, oh, I'm not sure about that one, I'm not going to spend my money on it, it's a case of, yeah, I'll totally read that in exchange for an honest review. It's very noticeable that this latest crop of sci-fi fantasy young adult fiction, a lot of it comes, you know, it comes out with a frenetic pace, as in you're literally launched in at the very beginning. And my real issue with that is, okay, on the one hand, I think we're kind of being conditioned to expect that from some of the films and things we get. And the thing is with a film is one frame can give you a lot of characterization and a lot of world building. Whereas in a book, just pitching someone in the middle of the action like that doesn't necessarily give you the building blocks for you to actually give a shit about the character.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a bit of an issue for me. So if you're starting in Medea Reis, then you better have a damn good way of making the reader care about the character.
Yeah.
One of the things I've seen, which is a bit of a cheap, and it's a cheap trick, but I love it, and I see it in urban fantasy, and I'm just like, I know it's a trick, but I don't care. It's so slickly done a lot of the time, is you have somebody who is your new urban fantasy main character in the first book or the second or third book before everyone knows who this person properly is. And they're fighting some awful, awful thing, and it's kind of funny and bad, and anything awful could happen. And you kind of care a little bit because this character is wisecracking. But so that keeps your attention. And then just as a fatal blow is about to come down, the character goes, I need to take you back a step to earlier this morning. And I'm like, that is such a cheap trick. That is literally, look over there while I put that shiny coin in my pocket kind of thing. And it's like, look at the shiny keys, follow the keys, follow the keys. Oh, what's this behind your ear? Is it an egg? And I'm like, okay, I know what you're doing. I absolutely know what you're doing. But when it's done well, it's kind of like, I don't care. It's kind of like, shut up and take my money, because that just really works for me. It is definitely an eating your cake and having it scenario, because you're being a bit tricky. You're kind of like, well, I'm starting with some action, but also you're going to care about the character because I'm going to take you away from the action and then back again, just so that you find them avoiding that seemingly fatal blow that I took you away from.
Yeah, and that's something that I've definitely done. I definitely did that with Castrol. I do think the other thing that actually tends to really help with urban fantasy is the use of first person.
Yeah.
I think that actually it's really a lot easier to become endeared to a character if they're actually talking to you. Just like, I don't know if anyone else has ever had that experience where you meet someone and you have sort of one conversation and suddenly you're like, wow, this person actually is my friend. Like, I actually really like this person.
You just click, yeah.
You just click. And that can happen a lot in urban fantasy, and that's kind of what you want to go for, which means that within, you know, that first scene where something's happening, you click with the character because they're actually talking to you at the same time. And that can help you kind of suddenly go, okay, we've gone from a really fast pace, that was really exciting. And now, actually, I'm curious about this person, so I'm willing for things to slow down and to kind of sit through and actually really learn about them because I genuinely want to know about them. So it can work very, very well.
Yeah, I think, and I don't mean this to be discouraging to anybody starting out with writing, but you're basically starting from the position of, and this was literally how it was told to me, no one wants to read your shit right up until they do.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is you have to present your No, I'm not going to follow that metaphor. That's going to go to a bad place. You have to present your writing in such a way that people think, well, maybe I will just read a little bit of it, and then they can't put it down.
Yeah.
Which, again, is where pacing comes in. And this sort of split action scene that you get at the beginning of urban fantasy, which is the shiniest of cheap tricks, is just a really good way of doing it. So study people who've done it, because for all that I have a bit of a bitch at Jim Butcher, he pulls that off really well. And
he really does.
Kim Harrison, again, I have a bit of a bitch at her, the way she set things up. Again, she does it really, really well. So it's really worth looking at. And to be honest, it doesn't have to be something catastrophic. It doesn't have to be, you know, Olaf the mountain troll has come down and it's literally trying to bash your head in. It can literally it's no spoiler to say the start of this of Slice of Death. Slice of Death is the first Harker and Blackthorne book, which features Amy as the main character. It's in first person, so I've already done that little trick. And she's teaching people at university, and she's trying desperately not to set the projector on fire while she teaches them. But the more tense she gets about teaching these people, the more smoke is billowing out of the projector. And you get her entire internal monologue as in, I know these people aren't stupid. Why are they not understanding what I'm trying to teach them?
Yeah.
Shit, is that a flame?
Oh, Amy. Perfect.
So, and it can be a lot of fun to write as well. So if you write urban fantasy, you might like to play around with that.
Yeah, definitely.
In other fantasy, but certainly in urban fantasy as well, you may well get a prologue. I am really, really picky about prologues. I think the problem is I've seen a lot of writers use them as a place to info dump background information and world building that they are too lazy to drip feed into their world and story. So they give you a massive, massive... I mean, the worst one I saw was, I think the prologue was nearly 30 pages long.
Oh my god.
And you didn't even meet the main character in it. And it was literally this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. It's kind of like, this isn't a prologue. This is a treatise on the religion and the setup of your world. If I see a prologue, I want to see no more than 2 pages. And I mean literally 2 sides of paper. Because if you can't say a prologue in that amount of time, then it's not really a prologue. Having said that, I will extend it for some things like urban, for epic fantasy, because sometimes you can add a legend or something in that is very relevant later on and just gives you a flavour.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're going to prologue, don't info dump, and it has to be relevant to that book. It can't be relevant to a book 6 books down the line in the series.
Yeah, yeah. I do actually think that actually quite a lot of fantasy and sometimes historical fiction as well, but mostly fantasy, are quite guilty of having very info-heavy prologues. Don't do it. It's a little bit like saying, the way I see it is, when you're writing something, what you're ultimately doing is you're asking someone to kind of jump in.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit like saying, jump into the pool, and they do, and it's just full of concrete. Or gravel.
broken
What's
glass.
Wrong?
That was Dive not in. Fun. Yeah, the other thing is, if you're writing fantasy or any of these other genres, you don't have to have a prologue. You can go straight in at chapter one. It doesn't have to be a prologue.
I'm guilty of prologues.
I do use them, but I usually try and keep them to a page. And okay, certainly how I have used them has been a case of, this is a little bit of cheat, but it's going to be something that's very relevant in the book later on. This is a taster to get you on board. And in one particular case, it was a sort of prologue in the sense of, I didn't call it a prologue, but it was the legend behind something else.
Mm.
But I think it was intriguing enough that most people kind of like, okay, I'm going to keep reading.
Yeah. Yeah. What I really can't stand is if I open a book and it's just there, like, there was once a land where, and I'm like, nope.
I'm like, no, that one's going to put. Do you ever do the thing where you open a book and it's kind of like, this is a promising looking fantasy, and you're like, first page, prologue. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to just skim through the book and see how many pages the prologue takes up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I always say that the first sentence is absolutely important. It is the most important thing. It's the hook. The second sentence is then equally as important because you've got to keep going. And then it's the first page. If you don't grab someone in the first page, you have to remember when you're writing a book, you are trying to convince someone to spend money on it. And one of the things that most people will do is that they might just look at the reviews on the back. They might just buy it on recommendation. But something that, you know, if you're going into a store or you're on Amazon, you read the first page to see whether it works for you. And if the first page doesn't work for someone, that's it. You could have written the most terrific book in the world. But if you have an appalling first page, it's really going to turn people off, which is why prologues, you have to be so careful with prologues.
Yeah, I mean, most agents will say, don't submit the prologue. Submit the first 50 pages after the prologue ends.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about it kind of thing. Because most agents find that the prologue is unnecessary and then tell their agented authors, once they take them on, to dump the prologue. So if the prologue is not relevant to your book, or if it's long and not immediately relevant to your book, get rid of it, ultimately. Probably the best thing to do. Having said that, if you're I've read it the other way, where I've read a prologue and it's been 20 pages long, but I haven't cared because the prologue has been just so amazing. And then when I've got to chapter one and 600 years have passed, I've been really disappointed. And as I've got into the book, it's been a kind of like, this isn't interesting me. So if you're like really invested in a long prologue, ask yourself why. Is that the story you should be writing instead of the one you're trying to write? Maybe your prologue is actually your story.
Definitely worth considering.
Okay, let's talk about a very tricky technique called bridging distance.
Yes.
This is one I'm not usually someone who says don't do this for beginners, but this is one of those things where I'm like, if you're just learning and you're only just starting, probably give this a miss for now, because the amount of effort, the amount of result is going to be disproportionate. And I mean, what we mean with bridging distance is you have the inciting incident of the main plot happen much later in the book, sometimes as much as 30% of the way into the story, but you keep your reader's interest with small relevant happenings right up until that point. That's called bridging distance. You're dangling your reader and you're doing it deliberately so that you can build up things like character interaction, background, and even world building to a certain extent until the inciting incident happens. And it gives you that extra slaps shock factor. So you are creating tension and you're creating suspense with it, but nothing is really, really happening on the main plot arc front until you get to that inciting incident.
Yeah. I think, potentially an example of this is Veronica Roth's Chosen Ones, actually. We read that quite recently. And I don't think it's a third of the way into the book, but the kind of inciting incident for sort of what happens it takes a little while to get to it.
You're a few chapters in, definitely.
Yeah. And it works very well because the world that we've been pulled into is so interesting. and feels familiar in a lot of ways and then very, you know, very different in other ways, that can actually really, really work without feeling like, oh God, I'm getting bored. When is the story going to begin? But it is quite challenging to do.
Yeah.
And it's not always appropriate to do either.
No, it's not. It has to fit the story. Ultimately, if you do it well, a reader won't even notice that's what you're doing to them. They won't notice that you're stringing them along, and they will be so invested in those characters winning by the time that the inciting incident happens that, you know, they will not be able to put the book down because it will just grab them like that. Mm. If you do it wrong, then they're just going to put the book down because they'll be bored. They'll say nothing's happening. And they'll be right in some respects because there'll be nothing happening of the main plot.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult to do because you're really stretching reader patience. I've done it once. I've done it once deliberately. At the time, even then, I thought, my God, maybe I should just cut out that top 30% of the book and start here instead. Mm. I didn't. Can you guess which book it was?
No. What was it?
It was Betwixt and Between.
Oh, my God.
The inciting incident doesn't actually happen until 30% of the way through the book when Kieran gets abducted.
Oh, my God! You're right! I didn't notice!
Well, there you go. I obviously did it right.
Damn!
There's lots of little things that happen up till then, and I shadow the inciting incident a lot, which is something you don't really get a chance to do as much of in the same way if you can't do bridging distance. But yeah, technically I could have got rid of 30% of that book and you just wouldn't have had the background of, you know, Em and Kieran having a nice time in Ireland and the build-up with the family and everything right up until it actually happened. I think the book was more impactful by leaving all of that in, ultimately.
Yeah.
Because when it did happen, you really felt bad for Em and Kieran, actually.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I do also think, however, that, and this is not me sort of saying that you couldn't have done this if it was a first book, I think it also really benefited from the fact that we were coming into a world where the characters had already been established.
Yeah, that would have been my set. I was going to say that as well, so I completely agree. It's a case of it was the unintentional fifth book in a series, technically unintentional sixth book in a series, and I was benefiting from a good following wind in the sense of I had the characters established, people were invested in this particular character interaction relationship, and so, you know, I wasn't stretching patience that I hadn't already earned, I guess, with the first sort of beginning part of that book.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, absolutely can be done, and it can be a great technique for added shock factor and, you know, tension and suspense and that. Don't recommend you start off thinking that's how I'm going to write my book if it's your very first book ever.
Yeah, I mean, you can make it work, but it is quite tough, and it's a hard sell as well. It can be a really, really hard sell.
Yeah.
So yeah, be warned.
I think another book that does it is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Suzanne Clarke.
Yes, definitely.
And I think you get even more bridging distance. I think you might be nearly 40% of the way into the book before you get Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell together, which is when things really start to take off.
Yeah, and I mean, I would even say that in the TV series as well, there was a lot of bridging distance. So much so that actually, I almost didn't continue watching after the first episode.
Really?
Yeah, I was sort of like, "What? When is this going to start?" And then I was like, oh, "All right, I'll watch the second episode." And then I was like, oh, "I'm in love."
Yeah, that's the funny thing about bridging distance as well, because you can go through it thinking this hasn't really got going yet, and then you fall in love with it when it does get going. And then you go back and either reread and or rewatch, and you love it even more the second time round because now you know when the inciting incident's going to happen. I think that's the reader psychology behind it. I don't think people necessarily consciously know that's why they're upset or whatever, but...
Yeah.
Okay, we have time for both Madeline and I to say a few of our favourite fast-paced, slow-paced books and things. The ones that worked for us. I suppose that's something we should have actually said, which we haven't, and that is a reader's perception of something being fast or slow paced will also depend on the reader.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, also, depending on what you're expecting from the novel itself. So if you're going into a particular genre, you're kind of expecting a certain pace that you're going to get out of it.
Yeah.
For instance, I don't expect to pick up a sort of Jane Austen-esque Regency novel and for it to kind of hurtle me forward at 100 miles an hour. That's not why I've gone to it.
Yeah. I mean, you have to think about style and how readers engage with style as well. So that's a good example. Yeah. Because actually, if you look at the pacing of Pride and Prejudice against your average spy thriller, they hit the same beats at the same time. It's just that the Regency language can put people off, so they find it a lot slower paced than it is. But if you click with the Regency style, which obviously I did, to me, that's a really superbly pacey novel.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that it's a slow novel at all, but just like with a spy thriller as well, the point with a spy thriller is that you have to have this build-up.
Oh, yeah.
Which means that you can't just kind of go hurtling into it usually. There has to be this sense of this build-up of atmosphere and of tension, and that's exactly the same in Pride and Prejudice. So I wouldn't expect to have a very, very fast beginning. I would expect it to actually have a steady speed-up throughout, basically, with, stops and starts throughout.
Yeah, here's one of my quandaries. Then, because I would have said for fast pace, I would generally say things like The Hollows or The Dresden Files. And generally, I would say, yeah, they're quite fast paced and they worked that way. But the weird thing is with some of the Harry Dresden books, I've been able to, when I've been reading them, it's been a case of I'm going to read 12 chapters and a go. But when I've put the book down, I haven't felt this compulsion to go back to it straight away. So there's something there that isn't quite working for me as a reader reading that particular style, and yet when I'm reading it, it's an enjoyable experience. It's fast paced, it's easy to read, it doesn't require too much of me, and I love the world building. So go figure.
I think that just might be personal. I haven't actually read any Harry Dresden for quite a while. I do remember when I picked up Stormfront, I loved it. I just finished it in a day. I just demolished it just so quickly because it was great. I believe I was ill as well, and it had been sat on my shelf, and I just thought, might as well. And I just couldn't put it down. I really, really enjoyed it. And I read these things. I read all of the Dresden Files very, very quickly. And I think you are right that they are very fast-paced. I can't say for... I never really had an experience where I would put them down because I did just gobble them up. Yeah, I think probably in terms of pace, the ones that I really think of are Game of Thrones.
What, fast-paced?
Oh, no.
Yeah, see, I haven't read all the Game of Thrones book, so I have to, say I haven't read all of A Song of Ice and Fire. I still haven't done it yet. Part of that is having got the gist of things from, spoilers and from the TV series and things. But also, I've enjoyed them, the first few books, whilst reading them. But at the same time, they've also had that I'm going to put them down and I don't need to pick them up again today kind of feel.
Yeah.
So...
And that's fair enough. I really, really liked them. The first one took me a few weeks to read. Because I really struggled with the pace of that one. I'm not great with high fantasy, actually, things considered.
Yeah, I mean, it's ponderous by its very nature. In a lot of it's ponderous because, as we've said in a previous episode, most high and epic fantasy is aping Lord of the Rings to some extent.
Yeah. After I got them through the first one, like, the next few, I would read each of them in a matter of days. Like, I would read an entire one over 2 days, no problem, right up until I got to book 5, and that took me months. And I think it was actually because, for me, looking at it in terms of actually a dozen different individual stories, the pace within each of the individual stories, rather than the pace of the whole book overall, worked for me. I liked the development of these characters. I could see them developing on page. They were each hitting their own kind of little points. And the problem for me was that I got to book 5 and suddenly went, I don't care. It was Feast for Crows. And I was like, I don't care about most of these characters. Yeah. I don't care about their stories. I don't actually know who half of these people are anymore, because he just kept bringing in these new people, and I was like, I'd turn the page and it would say like the Griffin Knight or something, and I'd be like, who the hell is that? You know what? I don't care about you. Take me back to the, you know, the few other characters that I could remember. It was just starting to get to be a little bit too much. So it took me months to finish it, and then the next book just didn't sway me nearly as much at all as the others had. I just suddenly just everything slowed down again.
Yeah.
Which was a real shame, really. So
I think you're right, and you're right in the sense of multiple viewpoint characters, certainly as many as Martin's got in his book.
Yeah.
Can actually hinder the pace as well as help it, because you end up sort of like, well, I care about these three in particular. Oh, but I've got 6 other viewpoint characters repeated 3 times before I get to the next one I actually want to read. So, well, you kind of want to skip ahead.
Yeah. And it got to the point actually as well where I was like, there are so many characters now, and what's happening is that I have to slow down and see them each develop over time. And that has actually resulted in the fact that the story itself isn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
We just seem to be in a rut where nothing is actually developing because there's just so many people that I'm now following. And I have to get through each and every one of them before the next event can occur. And it just got a bit too much, and there were just too many events.
I mean, I have heard a couple of epic fantasy writers who write massive, massive tomes say that they write books that size because they're intended for people to really get their teeth into and sort of chew through them over a couple of months. And I'm like, I'm not going to commit to one book for 2 months. Sod that. If it doesn't draw me, put it this way, I read The Stand, the first time I read The Stand, which is well over 1,000 pages, the first time I read it in 48 hours, and I probably made myself quite peculiar by doing that, because I was so immersed in the world I didn't fully emerge again. And I think a week later I started it again because I just needed to go back in. But if you can grab me like that, and some of it is personal preference, definitely. If you can grab me like that, then you're not going to give me a 1,000-page book that I'm going to eke out over 2 months. That's not going to happen. So basically, that is not how I read books. If you want to give me a big fantasy tome, I'm looking at a week. That is how much time I will give to your big fantasy book. I'm pretty sure I read both of your Hamartia books in like 24 hours.
You did. You read them so fast.
That's what I mean. I slow down for no one. You give me something I want to read. I don't see stop signs.
Jules, I slow down for no book. For no man.
This is why I'm confused by the Harry Dresden thing for me, and I can't put my finger on it, but I think it was the book before Changes where it took me 3 weeks to read it because I just kept putting it down and wouldn't pick it up. And I know that book is shorter than either of your Hamartia cycle books. And yet I know I read those in 24 hours, so I'm kind of like, there's something not right here.
I honestly think that sometimes it is just about the kind of the time. Sometimes you're just not in the right mood for a certain book or for a certain story, even if you objectively like it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Because I've started so many books and thought, I actually kind of like this. For instance, I read The Gospel of Loki, and now there's the second book, The Testament of Loki.
Yeah.
And objectively, I liked it, and I was halfway through it, and I just put it to the side, and I haven't picked it up since. I've had no desire to go back to it. And I know it's at another point, I might have just picked it up and then not put it down until it was done. But sometimes you just are not in the right frame of mind for a particular book, and that's just the way that it works.
I mean, I have done that and just, you know, put them down, put a book down, and then gone back to it a couple of months later, and it's been the right time. So learning to recognise that's important. But it was a case of when I'm reading it, I'm really enjoying it, but when I put it down, it's kind of like, I've forgotten about it. You know, it's like a child with an abandoned toy kind of thing. I don't know. I think, honestly, the quality in the series does vary quite drastically as well. And, you know, what sort of story each book in that series encapsulates also varies. So some of them hit your beats and some of them don't.
Well, the nice thing, I think, about the Dresden Files is that it kind of actually is covering lots and lots of different sort of subgenres sometimes.
Yeah.
Which means that sometimes it will be something you really gel with, and then sometimes it will just be something that you're less interested in. But it's just because there's so much variety. So, I guess that's actually part of the reason that I do like the series, but I haven't read the latest book yet, so...
It's like, well, despite my gripes, I keep going back because now the world is established, I really enjoy the world, and there's certain characters that I'm just kind of like, I need to check in on you. I need to see how Butters is doing.
I knew it was going to be Butters. I was just waiting for you to go, Butters!
It's my precious cinnamon roll. It's like, nothing may happen to Butters. And there are others I obviously care about as well. I really like Molly.
Yeah. I like Thomas.
I like Thomas. Oh, Thomas does not have a good time in peace talks.
No! Well, I'm kind of glad, because I do like to see him suffer.
Oh, but, you'll see him suffer.
Yay!
I got an arc of peace talks, by the way, which is the next book in the Dresden Files. It comes out in August. And then the next one after that is Battleground, which comes out in, I think, September, October.
See, I'm really excited, because... August and September are going to be such good months for me, because I'm going to have the Dresden Files, and then I'm also going to have the next Gentleman Bastard sequence book coming out. There's another one which is actually funny with pace. My favourite Gentleman Bastard books, I mean, I loved The Lies of Loch Lomora, which started off so slow. The only way I can describe The Lies of Loch Lomora, it's like a snowball.
Yeah.
Where it just gathering momentum as it goes down a hill.
It felt to me a bit like two different books torn apart and stitched back together. That's not a criticism.
This is where Jules and I divide.
I actually liked it, but there were things that didn't work for me. It's not a criticism to say it felt like two different books stitched back together. That can really work. Things like Cloud Atlas.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed Red Seas Under Red Skies.
Yeah, that was my absolute favourite, I think. I really, really loved book one, but I got a bit hindered by some of the world building because I'm just not great with it. But... book two actually should have hindered me just as much, because there's lots of technical stuff with the ships and stuff like that, and the sailing.
Yeah.
But I listened to the... I think I read it, and I kind of just skimmed over a lot of the technical stuff. And then I listened to the audiobook whilst on a sort of a 12-hour coach journey to France. And it was actually really soothing, because I was sort of half snoozing. But... this is completely random, but every now and again, in the audiobook, they'd shout "Captain" in such a way that I would wake up. It was so funny to me, because every time it was like "Captain," I was like, "What? What? What is it?"
Oh dear.
So yeah, so I really liked it.
I have to say, I'm a fan of a slow unwind fantasy book that's giving you plenty of world and lots of character development. If you do that right, I don't mind that it's going slow, or that it's taking its time, or it's taking its space, because that kind of works for me. Mm. I think where it comes a bit of a cropper is if you can't make me care for the characters and you're still going at that pace, then that's... you're not going to keep my interest, which is kind of where I sort of shelved Game of Thrones from book four onwards, just because I will read them someday. It's just a case of they stopped being a priority for me.
Sorry, it is book four. But book four is Feast for Crows, isn't it?
I think so.
It's the red one. Yeah.
The red
one. The one which has got, which is, sorry, it's just in my head. I see the colours. It's the one which focuses on like Cersei and it has Jaime and stuff like that. Jaime's was the only point of view that I actually cared about in that book.
Yeah, it's tough if you think, I actually don't care about, I mean, I don't have to like a character, but if I don't want to know what happened, I don't even have to root for them, but I need to know, want to know what happens to them. And if I don't, it's like, what is the point? This is clearly not for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I really enjoyed The Traitor Barry Cormorant by Seth Dickinson. And I've enjoyed the second book in that series, and I've just got an arc of the third book, and I know they're all going to be as ponderously paced because it's very detailed economic warfare, which is not going to be to everyone's taste. It's a very technical thinky book. I loved it, but I can see why someone else is just going to look at it and just go, this is not me.
Yeah, that would be me.
Yeah, I've not sort of said, oh, you must read this, Madeline, because I'm kind of like, yeah, I know you're not going to enjoy the way that's written.
No, not at all. Well, I think we've actually come to the end of the episode.
We have indeed.
Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, I've got a slightly weird one for you. So, for the first time, I'm actually going to recommend an album of music. Now, this is the part where I reveal some of my music tastes, and some of you might heavily disagree with me.
Dum, dum, dum!
But if you enjoyed The Witcher and you liked the character of Jaskier and his, you know, his song and his singing, I actually really recommend that you check out the actor's music. So his name is Joey Beatty, and he's part of a band called The Amazing Devil. And he and his partner, they're brilliant songwriters, really, really fantastic music. And I have been listening on repeat to their album, The Horror and the Wild, which is just fantastic. It's really wordy, very story-filled. There's a lot of, it's really about characters, and there's a lot of character in their fantastic sense of narrative. This is, I mean, ultimately why I'm actually recommending this, is because each of the songs has a great sense of story to it. They're all catchy, beautifully sung, and there's a nice kind of diverse sort of mix of music within the album. So that's The Horror and the Wild. The band is called The Amazing Devil. The whole album is about 45 minutes long, so it's not actually a very long album at all. It does have some pretty explicit songs. They're quite sweary, but it's actually really beautiful, and there's something incredibly nostalgic and occasionally harrowing, but also very funny about these kinds of songs. They really sort of make you feel stuff. So I really, really recommend it. And if you do have a listen to it, do leave us a comment to say what you thought about it, and whether you kind of got any stories from the songs as well.
Cool. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I really do recommend it. I've really, really enjoyed listening to it.
And I've had a lot more time to listen to music lately, so that's good.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thank you so much for listening. We hope that everyone is keeping safe and well. So until next time, thanks and goodbye.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.